Hey folks, my name is Chris and I work on the brand team here at Red Hat. And welcome to our latest in our Open Your World webcast series. For those of you who are new to the site, opensource.com is a community focusing on how open source principles like rapid prototyping, transparency, collaboration, and meritocracy are changing the world around us. Before I introduce today's guest speaker, let's talk about a few housekeeping items to make sure everyone has a great experience. First up, if you experience any buffering or connectivity issues, please press F5 on your keyboard to refresh the webcast player. Also, as you know, we're all about collaboration, and we'd love to hear from you. Please submit your feedback and questions by clicking on the Ask a Question box on the right of your screen. Simply enter your comment and then click Submit. We'll do our best to answer as many questions as time allows. And finally, if you are planning to tweet about today's webcast, please use our hashtag, #OYWF, for Open Your World Forum, and follow us at Open Source Way, all one word, for updates throughout the webcast. As you know, today we are joined by New York Times bestselling author and founder of the Altimeter Group, Charlene Lee. Charlene is widely known as an all-around expert on social media, organizational strategy, technology trends, interactive media, marketing, and really the future of leadership overall. Charlene is someone who we at opensource.com truly believe understands the principles of open source and the direction of the open source way. She is an advocate of transparency in business, openness in leadership, meritocracy in development, and fail early, fail often mantra of prototyping. For all these reasons and more, we are thrilled to have Charlene join us for as one of the great speakers in our Open Your World webcast series. Charlene, thanks for joining us, and take it away.
Hey, thank you very much for having me here. And so I am going to talk about openness, and in particular, some of the challenges that organizations and their leaders are facing in this new open world. And just to start it off, I thought I'd talk about, first of all, what does this world look like? And here's an example. I put on here all the different social networking and publishing sites that are sort of on the radar for many organizations. You've got Facebook at the center of all of this as the 800-pound or 800 million member of behemoth. And then you have all these other places like Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn, of course. But you have many, many other different places, and it's very diverse, especially if you move outside of the United States. So it's not only just very diverse and people are going to many different places, but it's also constantly changing. And when I talk to organizations, the key thing that comes back is, well, how do we actually, you know, engage? How do we get in control of the situation? How do we have a strategy around it? And more importantly, how do I lead in this new world? And the question that comes up oftentimes is this: how open do I need to be? How authentic, how transparent, how real do I need to be? And it's a realization that you can't be completely 100% open. Nobody is in their professional lives or even in their personal lives. And yet there is this demand and this need to do this. And there's also an underlying sense that people are feeling very much out of control when they come into this new world because they don't know what the rules are. They don't know how open they need to be. And so this whole idea of being out of control, I think, is very symptomatic of the fear that people are feeling and therefore the hesitancy of being open. What happens when I do? If I become open, that's synonymous with not being in control. If I'm not in control, that's not acceptable because I can't operate in an out-of-control world. So I thought I'd give an example just to illustrate how out of control the world actually is. And so the first example I want to give is what happened to Dell. And this is a picture of one of their laptops spontaneously combusting. And it was at, this actually took place in Osaka, Japan in June of 2006. And the laptop was just sitting there at a conference, and it started smoking, and then it caught on fire. Now, Dell, at the same exact time, had just launched their blog, the first blog that they had. And they were talking about great servers that they had, the gaming machines, how fast they were, all these beautiful laptops that were starting to come out in different colors. They were talking about anything and everything except the fact that this laptop had caught on fire. And then the chief blogger said, you know, this isn't working because we're getting criticized. People are saying, what's going on with my laptops? what's going to happen to them. Can I fly with them? Is it safe to use them? I can feel it's getting kind of warm on my lap. Do I have to worry about it like catching on fire, catching me on fire? So Lionel said, I have to do something about this. And he went to Michael Dell, the CEO, and said, we need to talk about this flaming laptop issue. And Michael Dell said, you know, you're absolutely right. We have this new blog. And our commitment as a company has always been about being direct to Dell, being direct to customers. And so we need to be direct in our communications, too. So please go ahead and write this post. So I thought I'd show you the post that Lionel wrote. And it says simply this, Flaming Notebook. That's the name of the title of the post. And he writes, beyond what you've heard in the blogosphere, there is no update on the now infamous Flaming Notebook from Osaka. And he links to that picture that I just showed you. He didn't shirk away from this. Dell didn't say, well, you know, what flaming laptop? It was pretty obvious it was their laptop that had caught on fire. And they were saying, we know about it, obviously. We're looking into it. We think it's the battery. And we'll give you an update as soon as we have more information. Lionel went on to write 12 different blog posts, 12 in total, talking about, yes, it is the battery, and we're going to be recalling them. This is what the recall is going to look like. This is how you get your new batteries. And he would answer all the questions that people had in the comments. He would group them together. He would answer them to the best of his ability. He would say when he didn't know what the answer was. He would work very closely with the customer service department so that when they had people calling in or emailing in and say, what's going on, they could answer the questions and then direct them back to the blogs where they could get more information and be involved in that conversation. The reason why Dell did this and why Lana was so good at doing this is they realized that there was more at stake here than just managing a bunch of series of negative comments or managing the reputation of the firm. What they realized very early on in their experiences with social media is that it is about relationships. It wasn't about the blog. It wasn't about new channels coming on board like Twitter or Facebook. It is really about the relationships that can form with these technologies. And the interesting thing about relationships is that you can't control them. When you give up that idea that you are in control or that you have to be in control, this need to be in control, then you can be much more open to the possibilities of what these relationships and the deepening of these relationships can bring. And it's only in that mindset of being in a relationship that allows you to actually, again, feel this new understand this new way of being open. So the keystone to this, I think, in many ways, is this. How do you actually give up control, give up the need to be in control, but still be in command, being able to accomplish the things that you want to do? So to understand how you can give up control but still be in command, I'm going to talk about three things today. I'm going to talk about strategy, about leadership, and about preparedness. So the first area is around strategy. And in particular, how do you create an open strategy? Now, strategy actually requires a plan. It requires goals. And I see four common goals across all of the open strategies that organizations will have. And again, this is not just about using social media. It is about how do you be open as an organization. And the four goals are this, to learn, dialogue, support, and innovate. And these will get high overarching goals of whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish. They tend to fall into one of these four buckets. The first and most important one is to learn what your customers and employees are saying and then be able to, from there, have a platform so it can have dialogue, support, and innovate. So I thought I'd show you a couple of different ways that people are starting to learn. One of the most important ways is to understand who are your customers and what are they doing, what are they saying. So one of the ways to do that is to use what I call social graphics. And I'm looking at the slides, and I think they're going to refresh. Let me just try that again. So there we go. So if you think about traditional ways of thinking about people, you have demographics or geographics, psychographics, and even some behavioral data. But there's a new area now where you have to look at how people are connecting to each other on a social basis. So how do they engage with each other? Who are they influencing, and who are they being influenced by? What are they being influenced by? And if you think about engagement in particular, there's a way to think about it in terms of a pyramid. And this is one way to look at it. At the very bottom are people who are engaged primarily in a very passive way, they're watching content, listening to podcasts, watching YouTube videos. Next level of engagement above that is when they start sharing the content with each other. One level above that is when they start commenting. They may leave one-off comments on a blog or YouTube. They may do a rating or review of a book or a piece of music or a movie. And then producing and curating are at the very top. Very few numbers of people engage in those areas. And producing is creating content for a very specific audience, and curating is moderating it, acting as an editor. The reason why I orange boxed out the bottom two layers is that while it's great to be looking for and wanting deeper engagement, you've got to build a firm foundation for that base level of engagement so that people can actually start feel comfortable sharing the content back and forth with each other. And it's that sharing that encourages the relationship to form. We'll talk about that in just a second, but I want to share some data with you, too, as well. I have data across 16 different countries, and I just picked four of them here. You can see in the United States that the numbers of people who are watching and sharing are pretty high, and it decreases substantially the higher you get up into the pyramid. Brazil and Korea have actually much higher incidences of commenting and producing, and that's partly because of the people who are using it. Again, there's class stratifications, especially in Brazil, so they're more connected with each other. But they also have a key difference in that the language is actually used by fewer numbers of millions of people in the world. So if you want to have content, you have to create it. They don't feel that whatever they're writing has been said. It may have been said in English, but not in Portuguese, not in Korean. So they have this greater impetus, this greater need to create content and to share it with each other, too, as well. So I want to give you an idea of how people are actually learning from all of this great content that's being created out there. And it's as simple as using basic search tools, like on Google or on Twitter. And this is an example of the Heart Association. Somebody wrote, I've been on the diet for six weeks, and I've lost all this weight, feeling fantastic. Now, what could the Heart Association do with that data? They could find out who this person is, how much her voice has been amplified, what other people have actually been interested in this. Has she stuck on the diet? What are the things going on that has changed in her life? How much better the quality of life has she had because of that diet? So tremendous amounts of learning just by simply being able to find people who are talking about your organization or your products. But more importantly, what I have in the orange box is this. What would happen if every single employee could become a listening post? And more importantly, put that listening and that learning into action in terms of the things that you do every day. This is about opening up the connections that you can have with your customers, with your employees, by simply using these basic search tools, these basic monitoring and analytical tools to be able to just understand what people are saying. So if every employee in an organization could go and hear what customers are saying and put that in context of the work that they do every day, if they could just change the way that they work so they're a little bit more attuned to what customers need, to what each other need, that their fellow employees needs, the productivity gains are just astronomical. It would blow away any Six Sigma program that you have. And all you have to do here is be open to the fact that somebody can be a pretty good listener, that people can benefit from hearing and being connected to each other in a more concrete, more organized way than having it filtered through, again, this very small funnel of market research or business intelligence analysts. So imagine if everybody could learn. And I think that's one of the foundations, I believe, of having an open strategy, of making it much more open in terms of access to that content. And frankly, that access is readily available through any browser, and anybody can become a fantastic listening learning post. Now, what do you do after you learn? Well, the next thing is you can start having a dialogue. Once you know what people are interested in, you can use it as a spark to be able to initiate conversations with people. And I want to show how one company took dialogue to a completely different level and started making money on it. So we're going back to Dell, and Dell has all these Twitter feeds and Facebook feeds, and one of the things they do is to put these things on Dell Outlet. Now, I can't build the slides here, but one of the things they put out there was there's a 15% off on this new laptop that we have. It's an excess inventory, so it's a 1737. So go and take a look at it. They have a link inside of Twitter. And somebody wrote back by the name of Sports to Rich, and he was kind of annoyed. He said, I went to the link and didn't find any. Why are you posting this? Now, one person wrote back from Dell and said, well, here's the link again. Maybe you were searching for the 1735 instead of the 737, and he writes back, yes, that's exactly what happened. Now, he actually didn't end up buying that laptop, but he's still a customer of Dell. He's pretty happy with them versus a poor experience that could have been really bad. And what he realized is that there was a person on the other side of that Dell Outlet Twitter handle. Her name is Stephanie Nelson, and she actually runs all of PR for Dell Outlet. And she is responsible for putting out all that information on Twitter to 2 million people who are following it. And she spends about 20-25% of her time managing just that channel, and last year put out $11 million in sales, again, directly through this channel. So that's a fantastic return on investment, 20% of one PR person's time driving $11 million in sales. But again, what they realized was that dialogue was possible here. You wouldn't necessarily have a dialogue with somebody if you saw this link in email. You would know that's an email newsletter. If you hit reply, it would just bounce back. But here on Twitter and social media, you typically expect that somebody is listening on the other side and is willing to engage in a dialogue. So dialogue, again, being one of those key goals, because that's where relationships are built. And I think you could argue that with Sports to Rich here, the relationship was not only built, but it was saved because Stephanie was there to be able to respond to his frustration. I want to go on to the third goal, which is support. And I believe that support can actually be very strategic rather than be a cost center. So here's an example from SolarWinds. They have a community forum. Again, many organizations have community forums, but they invest heavily in this forum, in the fact that they have dashboards, people are in there facilitating the conversations, and they have 80,000 people, their customers, participating in this. And they see product development ideas, they provide support, they innovate with people, so people across the organization are seeing this as a strategic asset. How strategic is it? Well, in May of 2009, the company went public. And when they went to Wall Street for their dog and pony show, they showed this community. They only had 15 minutes to convince all of these investors to invest in their IPO. And they took time to show this community. And the reason they did that is that they said, you could take away our engineers, you can take away our technologies, our patents, and we would still be a great company because we have this incredible connection and relationship with our customers. And it's because of this community forum, we actively manage it, support it, feed it, invest in it, nurture it, because we know how important it is. Without it, we would be nothing, but with it, because we have them there, they will never leave us. Because if they're unhappy, they're going to tell us, we're going to try our best to fix it, and they support each other. So I think the opportunity here is to rethink the way support is done. If you open it up to being more than just 2 people or 8 people or 16 people responding to questions, but it's actually the entire company, it's the entire customer base, the partner ecosystem, who is a member of this community, then it becomes actually very strategic. So to manage this entire community, SolarWinds has 2 people. That's it. And they've only had those people because they can scale because of their open approach to this. My last example is around innovation. Innovation is the lifeblood of a company, and in many cases, the future of where the company is going to be heading. And I think Starbucks did a fantastic job of using these technologies to be able to create a new type of relationship around innovation. So the very first thing they did in social technologies was to launch this site called MyStarbucksIdea.com. Anybody can come and post up an idea, and from there, 50 different people inside the organization can actually see these things and then respond to them. It's not somebody in the social media team. They run the site, but the people responsible for this are the people in each of those functional areas. So it's a little bit hard to read, but this example is about automatic ordering via swipe card. And this is one of my favorite ideas because my pet peeve when I walk into a Starbucks is that I typically just get a medium drip coffee. And I have to wait behind all these people who are ordering double macchiatos with foam and hazelnut syrups and all these fancy drinks. I have to wait for them to give the orders. I want to be able to just take my swipe card, swipe it to a machine, walk up to the counter, pick up my coffee, and walk out because I haven't had my coffee yet. I don't want to talk to anybody. Now, this is a great idea. Thousands of people have voted for it. Over 300 people have actually commented on it. And the CIO comes along and says, you know, we can do this. We can link your favorite drink to your Starbucks loyalty card. And people are cheering. They're saying, great, we're fantastic. This is going to be great. But then the store design person comes on and says, we've been running all these tests, and we just can't do this right now. We tested the swipe cards at this location. We try to do order taking in the back end, and we're just not ready to do this. We want to. It's at the top of the list, but we have to get some other things in order first. Now, Starbucks basically said no to these thousands of people who want this idea to be in place. But they acknowledge it, said that we're trying to do it. There are some things we can do, some things we can't, and hopefully we can do it in the future. The relationship between Starbucks and those people is better because of this, because they were open and transparent about what that process looked like, and because the people who wanted this idea to happen felt that they were being listened to. They got an explanation to say, you know, we know it's important, but we explained to you why we can't do it. Therefore, even though the answer was no, the relationship is stronger as a result. So I do want to go on and talk a little bit now about leadership in particular and how leadership is changing in the face of all of this openness. And I wrote a book, which I'm just going to talk about very briefly here, called Open Leadership. And I define open leadership as having the confidence and the humility to give up that control to be in command, while inspiring at the same time the commitment from people to accomplish their goals. So confidence and humility sometimes feel like they're just the positions of each other. Confidence means that you know that when you give up control, that you're not actually losing anything because you realize you weren't in control in the first place. And you feel secure enough to be able to say, at the same time, I can still get these goals done. And humility says that I am still learning. I am still open to the possibilities that I can make mistakes and that I, as a person, will grow, an organization will grow from this, and that we need to pull in lots of different sources of expertise and information in order to accomplish these same goals. Now, there are two traits of open leaders that I think you all would understand. I feel like in some ways I'm preaching to the choir, which I am here. And the two traits of open leaders are authenticity and transparency, two words that are very, very important, very deep words that are often thrown around with, you know, well, of course you would want to be authentic. Of course you want to be transparent. But I think the key learning here and the research I found is that you can be as authentic as you want, but you won't be perceived as being authentic unless that relationship is there. Here's an example. Chris Pratley, who is the first blogger at Microsoft, he was at the time a product manager for OneNote, started a blog. And he said, I really want to get feedback from people about this new product. And people looked at it and said, you know, you're a product manager. You're just here to push your product. You're not here and interested in a real dialogue. So nobody paid attention to him. And he just kept at it. He goes, no, really, I want your opinion. For example, would you like this or that? We can't make up our minds about this. We'd love to get your feedback on it. And a few people would cautiously give their opinions on things. And to everyone's surprise, he came back and said, wow, that's really good. We hadn't thought about that. Thank you so much. He had to build his relationship with people, build that level of trust. He was authentic from day one, but he was not perceived as being authentic. And I think that's one of the biggest issues that people have when they struggle with, how do I be authentic? It is not about you being authentic. It is what level of conversation and relationship the people you are trying to connect with, what do they need? Transparency is very much in the same vein. You may feel like you're being pretty open about what information you're sharing, but it may not be enough. So here's my favorite example of transparency right now. If you ever ordered a Domino's pizza, you know it, you don't usually order it because of its good taste. You order it because it's going to show up at your doorstep in 30 minutes. Well, the CEO got tired of this. He made an ad and said, you know, we know our pizzas taste terrible, and we're tired of this. We're going to do this pizza turnaround. We're going to look at our pizzas and redesign them from the pan up. New crust, new sauce, new cheese, new baking methods so that when it comes and shows up at your door in 30 minutes, it's not some massive mess of gooey cheese. And they've documented this. They've gone on national television. They have ad campaigns talking about, yes, we know our pizzas stink, and this is what we're going to do about it. The general reaction from this is, wow, this is everybody knew this, but that took guts. It's bold. It's different. It's refreshing that a company can be transparent in this way. And I believe in the age of open dialogues, of WikiLeaks, of this call, this need for transparency, this is a very important thing for organizations and leaders in particular to be able to embrace. So one of the ways to do this is to say, how open do you need to be? The way to do that and answer that is, first of all, to assess how open are you today? And one of the things I do in the book is to define the 10 different ways that people can be open. And they're grouped into ways of information sharing, where you can be open, and then how decision-making can be open, too. Two very different ways of thinking about being open. Let's take a look at the information sharing. For example, Starbucks was explaining how it makes its decisions about whether to offer new things like swipe card ordering, updating, giving people updates in terms of what's happening in the organization, conversing as we saw some of the dialogue that people like Dell were entering into. Open mic is when you invite anybody to come up, step up to the mic and contribute something. And like most open mic nights at comedy clubs, some of it's really good and some of it is pretty awful. So you never quite know what you're going to get. But there's always a chance that some of it might be really good. Crowdsourcing is very different. That's when you have a very specific problem and you're asking people to say, help come and solve this problem together. And then there's platforms where, again, there's data, APIs, databases that you can make available to people, and also just protocols, more greater visibility into how a company actually works so you become much more of a platform and make it easier for people to use your products and standards. Now, when you think about traditional open source problems, technologies and things like that, they tend to operate in the bottom part of this, this list of information sharing. And they also operate in the way that decisions are actually made. So sometimes things are very centralized. Sometimes things are very democratic. People vote and decide which is the right solution and decision to make. Sometimes it's built on consensus where everybody has to agree. Hiring, for example, tends to be done on a consensus basis. And distributed is something, again, I think that open source is really good at. I'll give you an example. When Firefox is out there and you want to make a change to it, it goes through, I think, about 120 different committees. Those committees, anybody can participate in them. The discussion happens. People give their comments on things. You're open micing and crowdsourcing the potential solutions. But in the end, there typically is one person who makes a decision and commits to code what the decision is. And you try to get to consensus as much as possible. You may do voting. But in the end, one person has the authority to actually commit. And what's interesting about this is that the way that you share information and the way you make decisions are going to be different in every circumstance. But the more open you are about that, and actually more open about the way you are going to make those decisions, about the way you're going to share information, is the linchpin here. It isn't about ultimately being completely open. It's about being appropriately open to accomplish the goals that you have. So to give you an example, we were working with an organization where they need to know how open they needed to be. Now, one of their key goals was that they needed to increase the number of ideas they had coming into the organization because they had really fallen behind in terms of their innovation pace. So they identified crowdsourcing as a key area where they needed to be much more open than where they were today. So the gray, the dark, the lighter lines were where they were today, and the darker lines was where they needed to be. They realized, though, that in order to build that crowdsourcing and do it over a long-term basis, they also needed to be much better at conversing and especially at explaining why they chose one particular solution versus another. Historically, they had been somewhat good at explaining, but they saw this, there was a tremendous need on the part of both their customers and their employees to be able to explain things more. People felt they were in the dark. They weren't in the know. They didn't have an idea of how decisions were made. And that sense of being out of the loop meant that they didn't feel empowered to be able to create solutions on behalf of the company. Because why do that if you didn't know what the outcome of your suggestion was going to be? So they decided they need to be much more open in terms of information sharing around explaining how decisions were made in order to support their ultimate goal of being able to crowdsource new solutions. So I thought I'd give you an example of how one company went about this whole idea of a question about how to become more open, and that's Best Buy. When they started, they created a social network called Blue Shirt Nation that connected all of the frontline people inside the organization. And they could create problems, they could air problems, solve them with each other, they could talk about what was going on the floor, and people from corporate would hear it and interact with them. And the people at corporate were becoming much more attuned to what was actually happening with customers in the stores. One of the executives who was very engaged with this is the CMO, Barry Judge. And he was engaged in the social networks internally, he was blogging internally, sharing insights, and people were encouraging him to say, no, maybe you should take this externally. You're the CMO, you're responsible for the voice of Best Buy, why don't you start a blog? And he thought that was a good idea, but he was really nervous about this. Barry, by his own admission, is a very command and control kind of guy. That's where he got to where he is. But over time, he realized that being much more open, again, having great humility of knowing what he did and didn't know, was really working much better for him. And he said, okay, fine, I will do this blog. It's going to be a good thing for us as an organization to do and a good thing for me. But he was so very nervous. So I thought I'd show you what his first blog post looked like. And this is what it says. He writes, the first post. Here it is, the first post. Phew, glad that's over. And that's all he wrote. Just 10 words. And he says, you know, that's all I wrote, but it was a way to get started. And he really did get started. He developed a fantastic voice. Very authentic, talking about decisions they were trying to make, how they decide what advertisements to run or not, responding to questions that people had. And then one day, he was in his office looking at the big screen TV he had in his office that has all of the reactions from people and the comments from people across the Internet coming across any mentions of Best Buy. He saw that the comments were extremely negative. He checked into it and found out that they had sent out an email to people that was supposed to go out to just 1,000 people and went out to the entire mailing list of 2.6 million people instead. And it was saying, welcome to our VIP loyalty program. And this is a trial, et cetera. It was, again, supposed to go out to this phone number, went out to the entire mailing list. They realized the mistake and sent out another email saying, sorry, that was a mistake. You were actually not a member of the VIP club. So you can imagine the uproar. People were coming back and saying, well, what am I? Am I not important to Best Buy? How could you do this? This is pretty lame. And so Barry figured out internally what they were going to do and say, and he sat down and wrote a blog post. And he said, this is what happened. And he very openly said, and this is just a horrible thing that we did. It makes me sick to my stomach thinking about the customer trust that we have just broken. This is what we're going to do about it, but it still doesn't feel like it's enough. What more do you think we should be doing? Now, he went from writing, phew, glad that's over, in his first post, to saying this very authentic, very personal view and take of what was going on. And you could see that in a very authentic way, because he had been building up this relationship, that he really meant it. Now, he gets more confidence. The organization gets more confidence as they do and take these small steps. Again, two steps forward, sometimes things go wrong, but they keep moving forward. And then in the summer of 2009, they launched a site called 12 Force. It is a site where anybody can come onto their Twitter page and ask a question, and any of 2,500 blue shirt employees of Best Buy can answer. The thing that is extraordinary about this is that any employee can sign up, see the back end, and be able to answer questions on behalf of Best Buy. So rather than just have a small number of people on a social media team or marketing team answering questions, they opened it up completely and empowered all of their employees to do this. Now, not all employees are doing this. Actually, a small number of people who feel comfortable with this and also feel like they want to develop that relationship with customers are doing this. They're also the ones who are ambitious. They want to become managers. They want to become members of the Geeks Club. So I thought I'd give you a personal example of how this worked. I went onto the site and I asked a question. what smartphone should I get for my 11-year-old son that also has parental controls on it? Then somebody wrote back and said, I think you should get an Android platform because it's much more likely that somebody will be able to write that kind of program on that platform. And because I have my location turned on, that person also said, and by the way, I'm at your local Best Buy store. Why don't you bring your son over on Saturday afternoon and we can look at phones together? My jaw just dropped at that response. It's just incredible that this person took it upon themselves to not only answer my question, but saw that I was local, nearby, took the initiative to answer my question in particular, and then said, please come in. I want to help you with this decision. So I think the interesting thing about this is that it is, again, using all of these new tools, but it took this three-year-long process to move from, again, having an internal social network to a place where the organization felt comfortable empowering so many people to speak on behalf of the company. Now, I get questions around, well, don't things go wrong? Of course they go wrong. Now, in the first year, they answered about 18,000 different questions on 12 Force, and they had about a dozen responses that they felt just went up to the quality and level of what Best Buy should be doing. Some of them were pretty innocuous. Some of them were really not appropriate. But again, because the people who are doing this are raising their hand, they get some training on this, they're invested in doing the right thing. And by and large, 18,000 answers, only 12 answers, a dozen answers or so, really not appropriate, that's a pretty good success rate, I would say. So I want to go on now and talk about how you can be prepared. How do you prepare for this new space? The first thing, I'm going to give you four things. The first one is create a culture of sharing. This is not something that happens overnight. I got some of the preliminary questions. Well, what do you do if your leadership style isn't open to this? What do you do if people are just hesitant to be open with each other? Well, you have to start someplace, and it could be as simple as finding the small steps that you can take around sharing content with people who need to hear it. So when I'm working with leaders, I oftentimes will ask them, you know, you're a leader. You have lots of things on your agenda. Which are the most important things that you want to accomplish? And of those things, who are the people who need to hear something? It could be a customer experience. It could be an insight that you have or you want to reinforce a message. Who would you want to talk to? Who would you want to share these experiences and insights with? And there's no shortage of that. You identify that. Then you identify how can you use these new tools to be able to share that information. So it's about expanding the horizons to say, how can sharing actually create a better relationship? And this culture of sharing, again, is something that companies need to develop both internally and externally to start feeling more comfortable with being open. The second thing is you want to create discipline. Now, openness and discipline don't necessarily go hand in hand, but the thing that I found most interesting in looking at open source projects in particular is that they are process-driven. It's very clear what you can contribute, who contributes it, how decisions are being made, who makes those decisions, what's the time frame for those contributions. It's all locked down. So even though the people who can participate and the solutions can be extremely open, the processes are laid out so we know how to be open with each other. This is a triage map from the U.S. Air Force. It shows when a message comes in, what do they do with it? So if it's positive or negative, they have different flows. If it's negative, who is it go to? How impactful is it? And it's all mapped out. Typically, what happens today is when people become more open, they start engaging with people, they usually entrust one or two people with it, and they have this sort of ad hoc process. They kind of figure it out as they go along what they should be doing with all these interactions. The problem with ad hoc is, especially if it rests in a few people, is that those people go on vacation. They walk out the door and leave the company. And what has walked out the door is your knowledge about how to have these relationships, how to share, how to be open. You can't afford to do that if you want openness to be a strategic advantage to you. So you need to have the discipline to set up the guidelines, the processes, and importantly also the metrics of determining, are you actually moving in the right direction or not? On the area of metrics, it's my third area of how to get started. And that is to ask the right questions around what actually creates value. Metrics are just a way to measure value. And the problem is that I think we're measuring the wrong things. So this is a quote from the CMO of American Express. And he says, we tend to overvalue the things we can measure and undervalue the things we cannot. Now, if you think about the theme for this, it's about the relationships. Relationships are notoriously difficult to measure. How can you tell the relationship is getting stronger, deeper, better? One of the ways is maybe lifetime value. Some organizations use Net Promoter Score. Other people look at customer satisfaction leading to customer loyalty and then customer retention and then maybe the entire way of looking at value. The reason I look at this is that social media is very difficult to measure beyond just the sort of engagement metrics of how many fans and followers you have. It's not how many you have, but what you do with them that's important. So how is it that when you interact with followers or fans on Facebook or on Twitter or on your blog, how does that deepen the relationship? How does that add value to your overall business goals that you're trying to achieve? The last area is around failure. And as Chris was saying at the beginning, this is about how do you have agile leadership in many ways, because you realize that no relationships are perfect in that they are prone to failure. And if you believe that, then you can take on what Google lives by, which is fail fast and fail smart. It is not about avoiding failure. It is about being resilient in the face of failure and knowing what to do with it when you get to that point. Now, most organizations still have this fear of failure. They really can't imagine a place. They need to be nurtured into that place where they feel more comfortable with it. And so there is a construct which I call the sandbox covenant that I find organizations find to be useful in thinking about this. The idea is you cannot be open, again, completely open. You have to define how open you will be. So define it. Draw a sandbox. Define what the walls are of what that sandbox is. It could be very small, but it needs to still be defined. How open will you be? So define those walls. Define what the rules of engagement, what the rules of being open, the rules of play, so to speak, inside that box will be. And also, very importantly, what the consequences will be if you step outside of that box. So many organizations have things like social media policies and guidelines, but I think it goes beyond that. It really is about this mindset of, I know there's a lot of black and a lot of white, what you should be doing, what you shouldn't be doing, but sometimes there's a lot of judgment that's involved too. And this is how you can start thinking about ways that you can be open and feel more comfortable with it. I want to give one quick example, and then we can open up for Q&A. When Citibank started their first Twitter account, the person who was running it went over to the legal department and said, you know, we need to do this. We need your blessing. The legal department said, of course you can have a Twitter page. I totally understand why you need to do this, but I need to approve every single one of your tweets. Now, you think about this, and you go, well, that's the most ridiculous thing you've ever heard, right? Especially if you live in this space. How can you approve every single tweet? And the person running the initiative, his name is Jamie Punishaw, he said, okay, I'll do this. We will be in your office 3 times a day with a stack of tweets for you to approve. After a couple of days, they decided to make this much more of an online process where they could just go through an email and then eventually a workflow that was online instead of looking at it on paper. But it still took quite a few months, about 4 months, before that sandbox would open up significantly. And the legal department said, you know, for this category of responses you have, things like thank you for opening the account, we don't have to approve those. But we still have to approve these other things. So that sandbox started out very, very small, very tightly controlled and defined. And as experience has come along, as people have built trust and a better understanding of how this whole thing works, as sandbox increases. So the problem I have with many organizations today is that they don't engage. They don't do anything for fear of failure. And I think that's probably the worst thing that you could do. I think it's much better to actually define even a small area, but leave it, but leaving it to chance is not a responsible way to even be closed. If you're going to be closed, I can understand that, but define what areas are going to be closed and what areas are going to be open. Take the time to have that discipline to actually decide where you want to be open and where you want to be closed and make it very clear for everybody. So just to close up, I do believe it is about the relationships. If you take nothing else away, that is what being open is about. And it is what using these technologies is. It's about having these relationships. And relationships in of themselves require a level of openness and for trust to develop. And if you do that, I believe that you can actually give up control but still be in command. So this is my contact information, and I encourage you to stay in touch. And at this point, Chris, I think we can open up for questions.
Yeah, thank you so much, Arlene. This has been incredible. In an awesome way, a question that came in directly about social relationships being different in different sectors that just came in live. The question is exactly, can you comment on how these concepts could apply to open government? Much of it seems relevant, but the nature of social relationships is a little bit different. With government, it's a bit forced.
In government, it's a bit forced. Well, you could say in every company, it feels somewhat forced because every organization is built on a hierarchy and people are in positions of power, and they control things, right? And what I'm saying is you actually control very little. I mean, you look at Obama, how much does he actually control? Can he make anything happen? No. Can anybody in Congress make anything happen? No. And this is reality of what it is. Now, when you look at open government, there's government at all levels, federal, state, local. And I think what's happening, again, there's some great, fantastic conversations happening on places like GovLoop, where government is becoming rapidly much, much more open. In the book, I talk about the State Department in particular and how they became so much more open when Clinton came in particular using these social technologies to form, again, what do? They do foreign relations. And so one of the most popular embassy pages is in Indonesia, in Jakarta in particular. I think it has 150,000 fans. And it's written in the local language. And it talks about all the different types of relationships that people are interested in. So it's a fantastic way for them to become much more open and be transparent about what the U.S.'s intentions are, especially in relationship to that particular country.
Yeah, we also had a question around healthcare as well, similar to saying that their industry is obviously, you know, very regulated with it, with the FDA and HIPAA and things like that, but it seems like there are a lot of parallels between government, you know, and healthcare as well, that though it is highly regulated, there are many ways in, you know, public and private that they're both regulated. So.
Yes. Regulated industries have a harder time with this because they have to be very careful, but that's where the sandbox covenant becomes so valuable as a tool. This is not about shutting everything down. It's about saying if we choose to be open, how will we be open? What areas make the most sense for us to begin with? We understand we cannot be completely open. Nobody can. So let's define it. And I think some of the organizations, I look at Wells Fargo, who's been absolutely fantastic in blogging and tweeting and creating virtual worlds. They understood from the very beginning that this was not about you know, sharing account numbers and everything online. This is about connecting with people and answering and treating people like people in the channels they choose to engage with you in.
Well, I guess, so with that, you know, as we're seeing that line is beginning to cross, and, you know, folks are, you know, identifying smaller sandboxes and then opening them up as they, you know, can kind of see the value and, as you said, treating people as people, are you seeing a lot of people that are, you know, having, you know, a big reaction, or, you know, how are the old command and control managers kind of responding to this, so the Barrys at Best Buys of the world, or there people like that?
Well, I go and point to, I can't talk about the clients in particular, but I'm thinking about one group in particular where at the beginning everybody's like, oh, this Twitter thing, another person coming and talking about Twitter. And I say, you know, this is not about Twitter. It's not about the channels. It's about the relationships. And it's not even about the control. When you realize that this is about business and business about relationships, I ask them, who are the best leaders you've ever worked for? The people you would follow to the ends of the earth. If you're fortunate to have had that, or people who come close to that, you know that they did not command and control you to get you to do great work. They inspired you. And they built a relationship with you. They got to know you. And at that point, all these people who usually sit there with very crossed arms and closed kind of body language are nodding like, yes, that's exactly the type of leader I want to be. And so it is about that connection. It is about that relationship. And then from there, if you say that as a foundation, then everything else flows from that in terms of the leadership structure, the way you give people incentives, the way you promote people, the way you train leaders flows from that.
So one other question that came in was a little bit kind of on the flip side, you know, asking about, you know, we've talked about a lot of kind of larger, broader consumer-based companies or organizations. What are smaller companies that maybe have, you know, that might mean the control or the power is even greater because it is such a smaller group of people? How are, you know, are there different, you know, strategies that you would advise them, or what feedback would you have?
Yeah, and again, it's the same drama being replayed again for small groups and departments and managers too. They feel like, okay, if I'm going to give control, what am I doing? Or actually what happens is somebody at CEO level will connect with somebody at frontline levels and say, hey, I've got a great connection with you. Come and have lunch with me, which is actually happening. And people on the front lines are like, oh, that's so great. We have all these new connections with executives, and the six layers of middle managers in between are freaked out. What do I do now?
Yeah.
And it is the promise, I think, of trying to make large organizations feel more like small organizations, where if I have the benefit of being able to see every single person in my company, it's a lot easier in many ways because that relationship is there.
Yeah.
And so being open actually is easier in small organizations, and it's harder in some ways too because you have to be more circumspect in terms of what you share with everybody. So the same rules apply. What will you be open about? What won't you be open about? Defining your sandbox covenant and making it very clear what those walls are for everybody.
So it's like you can read my mind, Charlie, and we're getting some great questions that are perfect segues. So one actually was a question about how can internal communications departments or other people that could kind of be shepherds of the open leadership mantra or ways, how could groups like that play into supporting and developing open leadership within an organization?
Yeah, I think internal comms is extremely important because if you think about creating a culture of sharing, that's where you are the sharing people. But instead of you controlling the communications that go on, how can you facilitate that happening? So the key thing for any communications professional is not about massaging the message or controlling the message, but how do you facilitate the dialogue to take place? So internal comms, you may want to think about putting in place things like an internal type of Twitter, like Yammer or Chatter or any of these things, Socialcast, Tibber, there's a whole bunch of them, to facilitate the internal communication so that it becomes more informal, becomes more real-time, and also increases in terms of the volume and also improves in terms of the quality, too. And internal comms, I don't think it's about just putting the technology in place. It's about really shaping and saying, what are the types of relationships that we want to come out of all of this sharing? So you need to structure it, you need to plan for it, put the right incentives in place, get the right people to show up and participate to be the sort of catalyst for these new conversations to take place. So there's a lot of work that internal comms has, but it's definitely not about them making sure that the communications happen or being the source of the communications, but them being facilitators.
Yeah, so that brings up a good point as far as, you know, kind of putting parameters or kind of having guidelines similar to, you know, kind of the walls and the sandbox, but also how do you navigate that sea of feedback or that mass amount of information that you are getting once those kind of walls are put up, but also, you know, a lot of information is flowing in response to questions or to open decision-making, things like that. How do you kind of navigate that sea of feedback, but also maintain productivity in the exchange and not kind of get too mired down in an abundance of feedback?
Yeah, I think, again, you have to distinguish between internal and external. Internal, you tend not to get so much that it's overwhelming, at least initially.
Yeah.
And as you grow your audience, as the feedback increases, you also have more people participating. So you can start filtering it using tags, using intelligent tools to be able to do filters for you. And, again, ideally, it's not just you doing it. It's a lot of people doing it. And the same thing with the external communications. Instead of thinking about it, oh, we're going to get overwhelmed by this, how does someone like Coke do it? They have, I think, like 20 million followers on Facebook. But the relationship they have with 20 million people is going to be very different than with 20,000 people. So this is what Coke writes on its page. Coke has the best fans in the world. We love you. And then 3,000 people will write back, and we love you too, Coke, in all different ways. They write back, you know, 10,000 people like it. So you don't respond to every single one of those things. That's a different type of relationship than saying, you know, we're a small company, B2B servicing, and we're going to put out, hey, we're very excited to bring this new technology to the market. We think it's going to help these people. And somebody like, oh, that's exactly what I was looking for, or I'm disappointed. You're not going to get thousands of responses. You'll be lucky to get one or two. Totally manageable. So different scale. Well, I would not be put off by engagement as a reason to say not to
That's true. One other question that came in kind of is on the flip side. Again, it says we're, you know, in some companies where trust breaks down, transparency can also be a problem. Recently, someone tweeted that a large internet company was going to divest from some popular products. This had lots of negative results. The information was shared transparently internally, and someone decided to tweet it. Was this a failure of transparency or a failure of trust or covenants, would you say?
Trust of covenants. That's exactly what that was. And I'll give you an example. In the book, I talk about how Facebook is very open about how much information they share with everyone. They really practice openness, where any employee can go onto the dashboard, see whatever's happening there. Mark Zuckerberg every week goes out there on Fridays and says, hey, ask any question you want. They do. But they also put in place, like, hey, if we share this information, we trust that you're not going to share it externally. They had a leak, I think about 2009 or so, and they called an all-hands meeting and said, you know, if this, we can't share this information with you in the future if it's going to leak. So we're putting the kibosh on this right now. If you want this information, it cannot leak. If it continues to leak, then we're going to stop sharing the information. It's your responsibility not to make this happen. So people, they didn't know who actually did it, but the people around that person did, and they put the pressure on that person. And there's peer pressure and covenants in place to not share that. And so they're very clear about what information they can't share. So when they're buying real estate, they don't tell people, oh, we're looking at these four properties. They tell people, we're going to be looking at properties, we're going to be moving around these areas, but we're not going to share any more information with you because, frankly, it diminishes our ability to negotiate good terms.
Yeah.
But we would want your feedback, you know, this is how we're going to run the process, but we're not going to share with you all the gory details. This is not appropriate. So that's explaining. That's being open and explaining. It's not being open and transparent about everything that you do. Two very distinct and very different things.
Well, thank you. I think we've had a sea of great questions, and you've done an amazing job in answering all of them. So we are coming up at the top of the hour, so I just want to kind of share a couple more housekeeping notes. We will have today's webcast live and on demand within a few hours of our webcast coming to completion, so we'll definitely share that link on our site. It'll actually be the exact same link that all of you who are joining us now are viewing on, so actually you can just refresh in about an hour or two and you'll be able to see the entire conversation, which has been amazing. Charlene, I want to thank you again for joining us and for being an advocate of open source principles and the open source way, and for sharing and taking some time with us to talk about open leadership and all of your great research and all that you've learned from other people and their stories with transparency. So thank you again.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks again for everybody who joined. And again, the on-demand version will be live soon, and you'll receive an email probably in the next few days. Thanks again.